Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
John Copenhaver and Al Warren. Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles.
102.3 FM Riverside.
And 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. John Copenhaver is here.
Hey, Al. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah. Did you wait up New Year's? Were you doing Christmas and all that? Did you wait for the balls to drop and
on the New Year's? No, I did not. I did not wait for the balls to drop. I was sick and in Nebraska, so, like, no.
Does that kind of come with hand in hand? If you're in Nebraska, you got to be sick, or what was going on?
No, I teach at a lawyer residency MFA program, and one of the in-residency parts of that program is right after Christmas, and it goes over New Year's. And so I was there and was sick. So not real sick, just cold, but it's like, I'm going to bed. Sorry, New Year's.
Well, it's not that big a deal. Older you get, the less thrilling it is. It's just another year closer to the end.
That's such a cheerful thought.
It's another, you're one step closer to death. 1 year closer. I'm such a cheery guy, hey? It's January, so we have to be that
way. Glass half full.
Yeah. Glass has got holes in it. Well, so now we've got a man here who's written a book who's pretty exciting. It's a thriller. No Home for Killers. Sounds like my house. It's a home for killers, so come on over. So we got Mr. E.A. Amer. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Al and John. Thank you. It's been great to talk with you again, and really good to be here. Looking forward to talking with you.
Well, so how did you get rooked into this writing thing?
So I heard your interview with Wanda Morris, which was fantastic, and she's such a great person. And she talked about how she, you know, this was her first novel that eventually sold, and she had to rework it and find an agent. And for me, it was so easy to write a book and get published. I had no idea what she was talking about. I really just wrote an idea on a cocktail napkin, sent it to my top agent. She picked it up and we sold it.
Did you write it with crayon?
There's a lot of truth to that story, but in a greater sense, it's not true at all. What really happened was I started writing seriously in 97 when I graduated college, and I got a job answering phones, and it was the only job I could get. And everybody who called, it was a political network, and everybody who called hated me and swore at me. And I thought, you know, I really loved writing, and it became kind of, reading and writing became a retreat for me at that job. And I had always thought about being a novelist. You know, you kind of imagine it, but it seems so daunting before you ever try to write a novel that, you know, it wasn't something I seriously considered. But I started, I had an experience that fueled it. And over the next 5 to 6 years, I told no one I was writing. Just, I wrote every night. You know, I took it seriously. For me, taking it seriously meant writing every day. That's not what it means to everybody, but for me, that was what it meant. And I finally had a novel ready to go. And that was in 2004. And then I got published for the first time in 2016. So there was a gap. Yeah. A gap of a lot of years and a few novels that are in drawers somewhere. Yeah, that was my path. It took a sort of an embarrassingly long time.
You need to sleep with more people.
You know, I slept my way to the middle.
Well, why stop there?
Well, the middle is where all the fun parts are.
Well, you got to get through this, right? And you got to get to the top.
Yeah, it took so long, and you know, for most writers, it takes a long time, and that's, you know, fine. I don't regret any part of my publishing path. It was really hard, but I've never ever taken anything for granted because of that. You know, every time I'm on a panel or something, I'm like, and I think maybe you both can relate to this. You know, it's so nice to be on this side of the stage. Finally, it's just such a lovely thing. And there's a lot more I want to do. Every writer, you know, has a healthy or an unhealthy dose of ambition, but I'm so excited that I was able to finally publish a book.
So what was it that gave you the courage to actually show your writing to people to try and publish it after sitting there for so many years? Well,
I had this sense that when I finished my book, it was going to be like Moses coming down from the mountain, holding commandments, and people would crowd around me waiting to see what I'd written. And keep in mind, wisely, I told no one what I was doing. So there was no writing organizations or friends or anyone who had any idea I was writing. And no one cared. And that first book it had a lot of heart, and that was about it. But you get that sense of, you know, of despondency, and you're in that I was in that mode where you're querying agents, and you have all this hope, and you don't know what the future holds. And as the future begins to sort of be revealed, that hope fades. It's being on submission is so crushing. Yeah. and so brutal. I felt like I was sort of built for that. You know, I was sort of built for this field. Like, yeah, it gets you down at times, but I'm sort of a okay person at getting knocked down. And yeah. Like, oh my God, that's a 90s song, isn't it? But yeah, but getting back up.
Yeah, I get so down. Yeah, that's right. So is that when you started to sleep with people?
I mean, no, I slept with people a lot later than I wanted.
Try the honest approach.
Yeah. And that didn't work. When in doubt, whip it out.
Well, Ed, I have a question for you because, you know, I know that, you know, I teach a lot of students in my MFA program. Of course, we've both been through MFA programs and the same one.
Oh, I didn't go get an MFA at Mason.
Oh, I thought you did from George Mason.
I got my, no? I studied writing there at the bachelor's, and I took a couple of MFA classes, but I got a master's in literature from Marymount.
Oh, okay. Oh, I don't know why I thought that. But, you know, I think that, you know, you're looking at them as sort of saying, like, you know, this, you're going to, you know, enter the sort of writing life and what to expect. There's a lot, and I'm sure you can relate to this, a lot of inside, you know, when you're learning, a lot of sort of instruction is focused on the craft, right? Not necessarily the industry.
Right.
And you know, you're kind of talking about how you kind of didn't have any connections or anything. You just wrote this novel and said, hello world, here's my novel. but on the flip side, one thing that I've always admired about you is that you're so great at, so you support others all the time in the community. You're, you know, like the Noir at the Bar and writing articles for a Washington Independent Review of Books. And I think that I just, when did you sort of figure that out, like along this journey? Like, when did you start figuring out how to do that?
Oh, well, thanks, John. That's nice. You know, it was really, I don't want to, dismiss that or elevate it, but I will say that it came from sort of a self-serving sense, right? I wanted to do stuff that would put me in people's minds, my writing, you know? So, and I noticed that when I was in the early days, when everybody was sort of, I think everybody was on Facebook at that point, I noticed that it was the people who have, who can help you, who really seem to have the most sort of buzz about them. You know, they'd put a comment and everybody would flock to them sort of. And I thought, you know, I want to get to that point. So it really started just from a naked sense of ambition. There was no sense of altruism or helping people or anything. I was like, you know, I want to do something that gets more attention to my writing and gets me sort of, you know, elevated above that. And then, you know, I started talking to it. My initial work with working with other writers was with the International Thriller Writers and their new members program. So I was working with debuts, and that's sort of where the altruism came, right? Because it's so nerve-wracking and so confusing, and there's so many questions that debut writers have, and almost all of them don't feel quite like they belong there, and they're not sure if it's going to get taken away. And I really wanted to help them. You know, I really wanted to work with those writers. And similar to that, at the time, I really wanted to work with to help women who were writing crime fiction, because I was working with International Thriller Writers, and I'd gone to Thriller Fest, and I had a fantastic time. It was the first conference I went to, and I made some of my closest friends there and have. But, you know, it was very much a male-dominated conference, and that was something I wanted to change. I talked to a woman who didn't feel comfortable there, and I wanted to sort of do what I can to change that. So I got more involved with ITW and worked on their board, and then started the Noir at the Bars thing. Was just, you know, kind of a fun thing to do. So that led to that. And yeah, it's actually at this point now, and you know, John, from working with people, like, when you're really invested in something, there's a lot of work you do that sort of is noticed, but there's a lot you do that no one knows, right? You're helping people, and working with others and working with organizations, and a lot of it's behind the scenes, and it's very taxing, and it takes a lot out of you, but I'm really glad I had those opportunities and those experiences.
They also put a lot back into you, right? Like, when you're doing that sort of stuff, I always find when you're helping people and working with people, you learn a lot yourself. Like, it changes you as a person too, right?
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, I started out with small publishers, the small publisher route. And I didn't, you know, working with debuts who were with, you know, the big five and were, you know, who had advances in the six or seven figures wasn't something I was familiar with. So I learned about the industry through them, I was still able to offer them some guidance, right? Because it's a lot of it's about knowing the organizations that'll help you and where to go and who to work with. And if I don't have a question, I can find it from somebody else. So after a while, you know, to your point, Al, yeah, you take a lot from that, and you really become, sort of a, I don't want to say an insider, but you have a little bit of that. You sort of have, I was sort of peering at the insiders.
It's almost like being in a political party.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I did one board meeting at Thriller Fest because I could only go. I was on the board for 2 years, and the second year I was hurt and couldn't go. And I was at this board meeting, and, you know, R.L. Stine and Lee Child and David Morrell are all right there and talking about, you know, their experiences in publishing. And it was fascinating to see these, you know, sort of giants and legends trading stories and stuff. And I was, you know, I was really happy to have that, to see that. And I still, I think I'll always take something from that.
So now this book, No Home for Killers, what's the basic premise of this book?
So a jazz musician is murdered, and he was abusive and privately abusive, publicly revered. And his two estranged sisters are brought together to find out what happened to him. One of the sisters, the older one, is a former social worker who's burnt out, and the younger one is a secret vigilante. I mean, she's also a grant writer because the vigilante thing doesn't pay. But it's more exciting to say she's a secret vigilante versus a grant writer. Nothing against grant writers.
I love that. That's so practical, and you know, kind of like it's like good advice for writers built in there. Like, you can't be just a vigilante, right?
No.
Get a real job.
Oh God.
Wow. So now, when you're putting together, what came first? Was it kind of the premise of the story, or was it your characters?
Gosh, I wish I had a good answer for this because I do not remember. I think it was the characters. I've been going through a phase, and I think I just got out of it where I've been really curious about siblings, and all of my recent writing and books have involved the relationship between siblings. So the idea of this, and I really wanted to write about jazz. Jazz was sort of my stomping ground for a long time as far as listening, not playing. And I wanted to incorporate that in a book and have a book that talked about art in, you know, in sort of a young artist, point of view. So the three siblings were really my impetus for the story. And then when it sold and my editor read it, one of her suggestions, because the jazz musician who's been murdered, the brother, has a point of view prior to his death. And she was like, you know, I really think the story is about his effect, sort of his ghostly lingering effect on his two sisters. And it's a story about women and the effect that corrosive men have on them. And I don't think you should give them a point of view. And all of her advice I resisted. And then by the final round of edits had taken willingly, you know? So yeah, it was the characters first, the characters that did it.
And that's a natural, the resistance is natural when you got editors and people coming back at you saying, well, telling you about what should change or what shouldn't change. I think that's a natural reaction, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, my favorite editing note from her was at the end, it was like, my God, she can't bite off his nose. and the thing is, like, I'm really desensitized to that. So I was like, why not? I don't get it. And so when the reviews came that said this book is, you know, you should know this book's violent, I was like, it is? You know, I really need a good that's why I'm really happy to be working with her, with Jessica Wells from Thomas and Mercer, because she's a good barometer for that. She's like, okay, you've crossed a line here. And I'm like, okay, good. Thank you. Cause I have no idea.
Right. Well, you know, not every family has people biting others' noses off and stuff like that. You know, that's just not, that's not the average family.
Well, I don't know what kind of PC culture you grew up in, but when I,
noses were flying off people's faces in my
family. We ate the weak siblings for lunch. No. Well, I'm Canadian raised, so, you know, we're boring. We do nothing like that. Put that out there right now.
Well, she didn't bite her brother's nose. I should mention that. It was somebody else.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. No.
She just bites random men's noses off. Yeah. You don't want to bite someone you know. You know, you want to get a different flavor in your mouth. Yeah. Well, so your characters, how do they come to you? How do you create them, or kind of explain your characters to you? And I say that because we get a lot of people that will, you know, they describe characters as family and kids, and some of them see them, some of them hear them, some of them don't. Like, what is it for you?
Yeah, I think that's cool when people say that. I was talking once to a children's writer who wrote books about a young girl, and she said it's just like she's sitting on the monitor, you know, kicking her legs, giving me ideas. And I was like, yeah, wow, you're an asshole. That does not happen to me. That sounds awesome, but no. No, for me, this was so No Home for Killers to me feels like my most personal book. And I think in a weird way I'm much more sensitive about it than I was about anything else I've written. And part of that is because I see this book sort of looking outside of myself as a progression. I'd noticed in my two other books before this that there was always that sort of wacky side character who was a little unhinged. And that character was kind of, you know, at times the comic relief, sort of the audience surrogate, but they died in my other two books. And people who read them were like, I was so bummed when blah, blah, blah died. And I was like, yeah, me too. Why did I do that? And it, you know, this sort of became an idea of like, let me take that side character and put her in the forefront and make her the real protagonist of the book. So Emily, the vigilante, who's a bit sort of delightfully unhinged, became the hero of it. And she was, you know, in a way, I took a bit of maybe all the characters I've written and kind of made her like a Frankenstein's type of monster, you know? But she doesn't, you know, I never felt a sense of, I have a very real idea of what my characters look like and sound like, but I don't have the point of having conversations with them, of talking with them, you know, of sometimes imagining that, you know, they're next to me or something. I've never had that experience. It sounds kind of cool, but it's not, but I'm usually able to separate them. I think part of it is because I usually, when I do a book, I print out images of the characters based off actors, based off people that you know, seem to remind me of this person. And I tape them around me in my office. And it's a nice way to feel submerged in the book, but also to remember, you know, what this character looks like, how they'd react, to keep them really sharp in my mind. One time when my son was born, we had a nanny and she had a best friend, and her best friend came over one time to help her out. And I was like, oh my God, you look just like the character I've described, like it was uncanny. So, and I didn't think any of this was weird. I went to Facebook, I found a picture of her, printed it out, and taped it on my wall. And then I was writing, and then my wife came in, you know, like a week later, and she's like, so why do you have a picture of Cindy on the wall? And I was like, you know, that's an awkward conversation. It would have been more awkward had it been Cindy, but if she had seen it, but yeah.
But that would be weird to walk into a room and see like that someone's imagining you as a character in their novel. I mean, even if it's not like you, but they're using your face and features to sort of fit for a character. I mean, I do, by the way, Ed, I do the same thing. All my books are set in the past, so I'm like reaching back for lots of people that probably aren't even with us anymore, stealing their pictures off the internet and using them as my, you know, inspiration. But it is an interesting thing, you know, you are borrowing someone else's image to do that.
Yeah, and I, you know, I feel like it's fine as long as it's a novel and I don't have like 40 pictures of somebody I know all around me in a dark office. But, you know, I do think there's something to it about this sense, and I think this is really interesting to me, and it's something I've been thinking about because Jordan Harper, the writer, sent out a newsletter where he talked about this, about creating a sort of an inspiration board that's based off random things, not, you know, that will put him in the novel that he's writing. So it can be, you know, even just like a torn bit of a sleeve or a ribbon or right. something like that. And it puts him in the right mindset to be in. And I find that fascinating because, yeah, I never have an issue with slipping into my book or the place where I left it when I stopped writing the day before. And I think part of it is because when I step into my office, I'm sort of immersed in that world. And to get to the point, you know, I was talking about it earlier at the start of this, that's something I dreamed about having the opportunity to do someday, right? To create a world and flesh it out and share it with it.
And do you find yourself drinking when you get in that room?
I drink a lot of coffee and I drink a lot of water because I'm terrified of kidney stones. So I drink like 8 bottles of water a day.
Wow. So, but how much of you is going into the characters? How much of you are you giving away?
I think a lot. You know, I worry, and I think this is something that you two and any writer can relate to. I put a lot of, you know, I'll occasionally put personal experiences in the book as a memory that someone had or a conversation, a story someone confided in me will make its way into a book. And I'll think about that when I write it. And then, you know, a few drafts later, I've forgotten where I got that story from. And it's changed a little bit. And the work gets published and someone is like, you know, that threesome was private. I'm like, wait, that was you. Right? So I worry about that. As far as me fitting into my, you know, like what comes from me personally otherwise, not a lot. I mean, I'm pretty boring. You know, I think most writers probably are, despite what their persona suggests. You know, I mean, we're nerds, right? We read a lot. We write a lot. There's some of us who do, you know, I went to war and I drank in a bar and stuff like that. But I kind of think those writers are BSing.
Yeah, they were probably doing dishes in the basement. So you said this is a very personal, probably the most personal book to you, right? And it's so that means it's important in a sense. What exactly is so personal? Is it a message you're trying to get to people? Something that you want a reader to take away from this book, other than the main story itself?
Yeah, you know, there's maybe 3 things about it that come to mind when I consider that your question, Al. It seems the first to me is, you know, as I mentioned, the evolution of the protagonist, you know, from what I'd written to really making that forefront. It felt, you hear writers a lot of times say, you know, I just wrote the book that I wanted to read. And for me, that's what this was, you know, so it was chancy in that. It was the approach that I kind of dreamed about taking, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't know if it would work. So there was a lot of fear in that, which really makes it feel more personal. The second thing was the jazz music. You know, jazz was an important part of my foundation when I started writing. That's when I discovered jazz, and the two went hand in hand. So writing about jazz in a novel really, this is unintentional, but it struck a chord. And then, I'm sorry. And then I'm a dad. And the third thing was, about it was, you know, sort of the end of the book. And I don't want to give it away, but there's when I write about violence, and as I mentioned, this is a violent, you know, book. I don't think it's more violent than most dark thrillers, but there is violence in it. And when I write about violence, I never write about it in a celebratory sense, right? I don't want, as much as I enjoy, I love Marvel. I'm a fanboy, and I love, you know, the good action sequence in a show or movie. But this book doesn't give you that. In this book, I want the violence to be unsettling. You know, I want it to feel real in that sense. When you are in, or you're even almost in a fight, that sense of fear and shakiness and sweatiness that you get, I wanted that to really come through. So for people who choose violence, and there's, you know, a few of them in this book, I don't want them to be heroic. You know, I don't want to write a Jack Reacher. You know, as much as, you know, I mentioned Lee Child before, and I greatly admire his prose, but I never took to Reacher as a character on a personal level. I didn't think, I always thought, like, what does Reacher do, like, on a Saturday night? You know, I mean, he's just kind of a lonely dude.
And he brings out the tools.
Yeah.
The power tools.
That's what I'm assuming, right? It seems in character, but I don't find those kind of characters for me fulfilling. Even though I do like a lot of those books and stories. But so for me, you know, this book is sort of a rebuke to that. It really, in some ways, encapsulates how I feel about the choice between violence or nonviolence. And that, putting in the book, I don't know, you know, how people will respond to it. You know, we want to write, you know, we want to tell the story we want to tell, but we want to also entertain people. And I don't truly know, and I don't think I will know until some time has passed if I achieve that.
You know, I'm really interested about this sort of topic of how you go about depicting violence. It's something I think a lot about too. I mean, maybe it's just something that as a crime writer you think about. I mean, a lot of your topics, if you do this, do center around violence. But yeah, I love that you point out that it's not necessarily the degree of violence, but it's how you position it morally within a book. In fact, yeah, Sometimes make more responsible for it to be a little more descriptive and graphic because you're honoring it's the horror of it. I don't know if that makes any sense. Would you agree, or what do you think?
I am so in sync with you right now. I'm just staring at your Zoom image right in the eye, like, man, I feel you. Because yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot, with violence and with sex. The general sense among crime fiction readers and sort of an industry sense is the camera politely turns away at some point. And I've noticed that I just think it's not fair to the character. I feel like if you don't show, you know, sex or violence in some degree of detail, then you're really missing an opportunity to show a vulnerability in a character that wouldn't be seen any other way. Yeah, and there's some writers now who I did an interview with Jennifer Hillier and May Cobb and Katie Gutierrez, all who had in their last books had sex somewhat vividly described, much more than traditional crime fiction does. And I'm just curious about it. You know, there's no mistake, by the way, that these were all women. I think because, and all women who have written around psychological fiction, because you're writing about the interior of people. And I think we were in a conversation about this a while ago, John, that, you know, that the sense of character in a book is, for me, much more compelling than the crime. Yeah, ideally, they'll go hand in hand. Ideally, I'll be on, and with great thrillers, I am, right? I want to know what happened. I had just finished the last Policeman trilogy by Ben Winters, and it was so fabulous. And the character and the story and the overarching dynamic of the plot just, you know, was like a nail being hit by a hammer. It was stunning. But to that sense, I wonder, like, are we shirking away from character by not going into more of these very personal, very, very human and very basic urges.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I tend to be a character writer first and then kind of work out the plot. So, I mean, I would argue, yes, we should, because I think it's what ultimately humanizes and fleshes out the fiction that we write, you know. And then if you are talking about stuff like violence and you've done a great job of developing a character, and then they're either committing the violence or they're subject to the violence, it's going to matter a lot more, right?
So
I just think that seems to be kind of important. I think that's important. I think that, but sometimes it requires a little more patience on the reader's part to learn about the character and get to know them so they're invested.
And I do think there's a power to leaving it to the reader's imagination. You know, I mean, one of the most beautiful romantic scenes I've read that had sort of a sexual energy to it was in F. Scott Fitzgerald's Last Tycoon, you know, where this man is with this woman and he is there, they're embracing and they're in this private, they're this empty house and something under her dress falls to the floor. And it's just like this beautiful moment, but that's Fitzgerald. So that's not really fair, but you know, it stuck with me for probably 25 years now. So I think there's an argument both ways, right? I mean, there's a power to doing something that's merely suggestive, and a power to writers like Karen Slaughter, who can really go into unsettling depth about violence and about violence situations and make them compulsively readable and also seemingly authentic and honest.
Now, when you took on this writing about two sisters and a brother, where did you draw from to get that relationship of siblings?
You know, I'm an only child, so I'm not sure. I think, like a lot of only children, you know, you sort of imagine having a sibling, especially during your, you know, early, lonely younger years. And I did have a cousin I was close to, and she and I, you know, had fun. We would hang out. We even hung out when we were older. Although then it got weird because you're at a restaurant and you were like, "Oh, is this your wife?" And you're like, "No, it's my cousin." And everyone thinks you're doing it. and I have
awkward.
And to be fair, I have very attractive cousins, so it's tough. I get it, but I think something about that relationship of dynamics of what I like about the siblings. I see my wife has two sisters, and there's this sense of, you know, no matter what happens, no matter frustrations they have, arguments, you know, but we'll go without talking for a while, there's always this like push and pull of siblings that's really fun. I don't think they find it fun, but as the outside person, I'm looking at it like, wow, you have this amazing dynamic, this relationship that you really don't have with anyone else. Like I know there's brothers and sisters, I've known them who've split apart completely, but the ones that don't, that linger around each other out of some sense of familial duty or love or the memories of love, those are the ones I just find fascinating. I love friendships that have weathered a bit, you know, and that's and sibling relationships to me are a very close representation of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting relationship that siblings can have, and that's why I was wondering like where you kind of drew from. So being an only child, so did you have imaginary brothers and sisters and that sort of?
No, I didn't. I mean, I did play, I was going to say with, oh God, I played by myself a lot, but you know, I had the whole imaginary, you know, like, I think this is maybe a common thing with children. Or I think I probably did it a bit more, you know, I had imaginary, like everything I had a voice and a conversation and a certain story arc in its life. You know, every stuffed animal, every toy figure I had, you know, even, gosh, my kid, it was two years ago, we were in quarantine, you know, in the pandemic, and we were pulling out like something to play with, and a bag of my marbles when I was a kid fell out, right? And there were these like 12 marbles, and I was like, oh yeah, that's Speedy, and that's Rough, and that's, and my wife and kid were looking at me like, are you naming them? I was like, no, those are their names when I, you guys didn't name your marbles. But yeah, I had very close relationships with, I guess, inanimate objects.
Wow. Do the stuffed animals still talk to you to this day?
No.
He's delaying too much. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, no, I don't. But sometimes I'm with my kid, and I'm like, you know, he's throwing a stuffed animal around the room. I'm like, well, you'll hurt it. No, you won't. It's a stuffed animal.
You can see him driving somewhere with stuffed animals seat belted in, and he's talking to them, you know, like going to the zoo.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be a point where things have really gone off the rails, but yeah, I could say it's not unimaginable.
No.
But to draw on these, I think, you know, for a lot of stuff, I look at my wife's relationships with her siblings and her sisters, and I do take a lot from that. My best friend for my whole life, her and her sister have had a very close, but at times, you know, contentious relationship. I look at that. Those are the people. It's not the kind of thing I research. You know, I find with some of that personal stuff, I don't need to like interview people about it, but it is the, but I think when I need answers about something, I look at that even without realizing it. But, you know, it took me a few drafts to realize that I'd written, you know, to put the connection together that one of my characters was a social worker and my wife's sister is a social worker. You know, never thought about that otherwise.
Right. Right. Subconscious. Writing evil characters or the murderer themselves. Do you have a problem writing that kind of character, or do you have any issues getting into the head of someone that would be a violent person?
Yeah, I usually, so with thrillers, one thing that I've always done is had, you know, the thrillers, the killers or the baddies POV in it, and I'll usually have a few of the bad guys, and they're I try to balance all of them out. Right, I try to give something about them that seems human and relatable and blah 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 blah, but there's always the one person who is remorseless, who's just a terrible person, and that person I usually don't offer humanity to. Yeah, and I think about that because I sort of, one of the things that's really inspired me is the TV show Fargo. Mm-hmm. And in the first 2 to 3 seasons, there was always a character who was kind of like No Country for Old Men, right? Like the person who was this remorseless, relentless killer who was just, you know, slowly walking after you, but they were coming, you know, sort of a symbol of death. And that's the character that I want to write. And it doesn't grant them humanity, but it does. I hate to think about it, but I do think that person exists, not throughout their life. You know, they were a kid, they were held, they were loved, they laughed, they, you know, giggled. But I do think that there's a point where there's people who have become irredeemable.
Well, and there's always something about usually the evil character or the bad person, as we like to think, they usually have in their mind reasons to do what they're doing. Like they think they're doing something good or something right, or there's a direction that they're in. So sometimes it's important to talk about that.
Yeah, sometimes, right? Sometimes there is, and sometimes there's evil that's done, you know, for the sake of evil. And I, you know, it's one of the things that really sort of set me on the direction of violence, you know, was violence to women, right? That was something that was around my life. You know, I was always in all male groups growing up. There was a fraternity or sports or, you know, Boy Scouts. And, you know, I'm colored by this, but the way they treated a woman struck me as, you know, really repugnant and very barbaric. And I was never a participant in those kind of conversations, but, you know, I wasn't the outspoken adversary to her. You know, I was the quiet, uncomfortable person on the other side of the room. And, you know, it struck me that there was a sense of sort of gleefulness in their hate. And when I, you know, sort of moved away from that and got away from those people and, you know, talked to more women. Most of my friends are women at this point, and it have been for, I don't know, 30 years or so, but, you know, it was very eye-awakening, right? Or eye-opening. You know, it was kind of like what the Me Too movement did for so many people, where they're like, wait, you get harassed? You know, mm-hmm. I had that sense, you know, a long time before. So it really spurred that. But I, you know, to get back to that sort of evil, it was this gleefulness, you know, and I don't think there is a point there with some of those people and some of their actions and some of the stuff we still read about, right? Whether it's sexual assault or rape or what have you, where there's any sense of you know, a person that I necessarily want to feel, you know, empathy toward.
Right. So how is it you feel you want to tell a story when it pertains to violence against, let's say, women or to someone that's less than, like, weaker than the person, you know, being the violent one? How is it you try to write that?
Well, it's tough, right? Because I've always written with my three books have had women as the protagonist, and I'm a little uncomfortable about that because I don't necessarily think in some ways I'm the right person to tell the story, right? And I don't want to, so I take a lot of pains to make sure that I'm not making the woman masculine, making them respond in ways that I would. With Emily, with this book, as a vigilante, you know, she chooses violence, and one of the first questions I had to deal with about that was, is that even realistic? Right? But Emily is sort of cartoonish, and in the book, I think it works. But it's something that I have to, my biggest concern with that is being fair and not taking a voice from someone who would tell it better than I do. So that's, you know, something that writers are wrestling with now, right? Questions of identity and who is appropriate to tell this story, and should you take certain points of view or perspectives? So I try to be fair to that. It's not something that I've been called out on, which I'm happy about, right? I'm not on the, you know, the men writing about sex Twitter.
Well, know. I'll make sure they're aware of it. Okay?
Yeah, if you could. But the good thing is, for me, is that I, you know, my agent's a woman, my editors have always been women, my early readers are women, and they're very, very, very quick and actually pretty happy to call me out on my BS. Right? So if there's something that I got wrong and it's, you know, egregiously wrong, they make sure I'm aware.
I think it's a sliding scale too, in a sense of, you know, you have a character that's a vigilante and, you know, she's biting people's noses off or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that might be exaggerated to what someone would say. It's not realistic, but in a sense, there's probably a lot of, women out there that, do vigilante acts in a much smaller way as a response that maybe people aren't always aware of.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with that at all. And I think that's where Melinda, her sister, and the former social worker really came in, right? As sort of the, you know, Emily is, the vigilante is, you know, cartoonish.
Right.
To an extent, right? She's climbing in windows and she's wearing a mask and she's got a baton. You know, there's a lot about her. And somebody said, and it was a good, it was a positive review that a bookstagrammer gave me, but they said, you have to suspend your disbelief with Emily. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, because on one hand, yeah, you kind of do. On the other hand, I don't want someone to read the book and think like, yeah, this isn't realistic whatsoever. But Melinda is the grounding person, right? So she's the other POV, you know, and she's the one who is in the real world, you feel the ground under her feet and the weariness and the exhaustion and the repulsion and stuff like that. And also the way that she responds to sort of the horror of the world is, I think, much more in line with a sort of more fully human character. I will say that as the novel continues, then Emily finds that, you know, when Emily has to become sort of more human, that's a very disorienting moment for her.
Right, right. But I think it's important in a way. I think it might exaggerate it some in her acts, but it kind of brings attention to what you're trying to have the reader understand.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to create, I wanted to write sort of a superhero, but I didn't want it to be, you know, I couldn't have her just, you know, fly away live blissfully, you know, afterwards. There had to be something, and that's the crux of the novel, without giving anything away, but, you know, is how these two sisters sort of cope with each other and with their, once they're, you know, brought back together, they're sort of the ground they stand on.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. You know, it's better than Jack Reacher.
You know, that sounds really good. I'm like, why didn't I put this in the synopsis or the back of the book? Yeah.
That's right. You know, I mean, let people know. Well, so do you like to interact with your fans? Do you like people to kind of respond and you know, make comments and talk to you and stuff? Do you have like social media? Do you have website? Like where is it people can find you?
So I love talking with people, as John knows. I usually they have to walk away, but the best way is my website probably. It's eamar.com, and on there's a link to my monthly newsletter called Crime Fiction Works. And in that, I have an author note about whatever I'm going through in writing. And then after that, I list books that month or the month before that came out that I'm excited about. So I try to make something that is about me, but also about crime fiction in general. And that's the best way to, and people respond to that. It seems to have taken off. So, and I like doing it. So it's that happy balance of, something I like that actually works. My website, eamar.com, you can subscribe to Crime Fiction Works, and that's the easiest and probably best way.
Perfect. Well, I'll have that up on our website as well, so people can find it with one click. Now, you also mentioned you had an OnlyFans page too. So what was that, so people can look that up?
Yeah, no, that's fine. That is, it's sexed.com.
That's good.
Are you under the name? You're under the name John Copenhaver. Is that it?
Yeah. If anybody, when you click it, you can enroll in sex ed.
Well, there we go. See, now we've learned a lot here. We know exactly.
Maybe too much.
Yeah, we know now the dangers of an only child. Well, we appreciate it. You know, of course, now the book we're talking about is No Home for Killers, and it's a thriller, and it's by our guest, E.A. Amar. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Al and John. This was awesome. I'm so happy to be in your lineup, and really appreciate the interview.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.housemysteryradio.com.
houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.